Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. Coming up on this week's programme, what are contrails doing to climate change? Really interesting and surprising research. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Fergus McAuliffe, Head of Research Engagement and Impact at Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Shelley Brady at the Insight Research Centre for Data Analytics at DCU. So, Fergus, our first story has to do with insulin pills. And this is a really cool idea that it was just harder than it sounds.
Exactly, yeah. So this is basically, it's all about insulin and diabetes. So just to quickly run through. So when you eat, your blood sugar rises. And then insulin is produced by the pancreas, and that acts as a key to open cells in your muscles to allow all that blood sugar to get in, and then the blood sugar itself drops. Now, diabetes is when that insulin either isn't produced or isn't working properly in the body. And so what you have to do is you have to inject insulin. Now, people have been doing that for a long time, but it's a daily burden. It's not necessarily nice to do, and especially in poorer countries where maybe those injectable devices are less available, it just makes everything harder. So there's always been this dream there to have this idea of like an oral insulin pill. Now, the issue is it's really hard to do because insulin itself is a protein, and when you take it into the gut or into the stomach, all of the stomach acids basically
obliterate it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's been described as this dream treatment. Now, what we have this particular week is a group of researchers in Japan. They have found potentially a breakthrough, and what they did is they created a peptide, and which is capable of passing through the small intestine. And they did two different things. First is they mixed the peptide with zinc-stabilized insulin, okay? And that then allowed the insulin to pass through the gut and into the bloodstream. And they fed that pill, in inverted quotation marks, to mice that were either chemically induced to have diabetes or genetically bred to have it. And it worked really well. So the amount of blood sugar came down, and it was actually stable for a number of days, provided that the mice were taking an oral pill every day. Then they tried it a different way, and they actually bonded the insulin directly to the peptide itself, and that had the same effect.
Okay.
So one other really interesting part about this is that one of the biggest obstacles for oral insulin is the need to have extremely high doses, like 10 times more than you would inject.
Yeah.
By doing it this way, they've managed to achieve what's called a pharmacological bioavailability of about a third as effective as a regular injection.
Okay.
So much better than what we had. Still not as good as an injection, but potentially down the line, this could be really exciting for a lot of people.
Look, this may be a really stupid question, but can you just take three pills?
Well, as things currently stand, this is just in the mouse model.
Yeah.
So it has a bit of a way to go. Very early days.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I think that's really exciting because, you know, the getting stuff to where it needs to be is a much more trickier thing than you might think. And the ingenious ways in which researchers are doing this through hydrogel, through, you know, topical creams. I remember we did this story on, it was a prophylactic that would basically replace a condom, and it was like a cream that you could massage into your shoulders. And I was thinking, what? Like, what is this? But you know, trying to get stuff to work in the body isn't as easy as it sounds. This is really interesting and very exciting. If that injection had to go away, there's lots of reasons why the injections are problematic. Shelley, our second story has to do with the moon base. So NASA basically nixed the human flight that was supposed to happen, I think it was this month. What exactly happened?
Well, what they've decided to do is make major changes to its plans for returning humans to the moon. So there's a new chief there, relatively new, sworn in to the agency in December. And the announcement he made this week was very interesting. So NASA have already largely built the Lunar Gateway Station. And this was meant to be a space station that was parked in lunar orbit. And it was designed to serve as both a research platform, but also a transfer station. So astronauts would be able to board moon landers and then descend down onto the lunar surface. But now none of that is happening. And NASA have announced that it's pausing the development of the Lunar Gateway. And instead, as part of a broader change to NASA's Artemis program, it's redirected its focus towards building a permanent base on the lunar surface. So Isaac Mann has said the goal is to support long-term human activity on the moon rather than relying on an infrastructure that's in orbit. So it seems to be all about returning astronauts to the moon, but also establishing a more sustained human presence there. So as you can imagine, this isn't going to be simple or cheap. They're going to repurpose the craft. So it's going to be take whatever they have, I suppose, already invested into the gateway, and they're going to make this now into something that they can put onto the surface of the moon, repurposing equipment, also repurposing international partner commitments. It's going to be challenging. It's expected to cost about $20 billion, and they think it should be completed in the next 7 years or so.
Right. This is a Trump appointee. So obviously the, you know, Trump wants to go to the moon and wants to make the moon thing his thing. I guess that's what this guy's going to try and implement. The recent Artemis launch, why was that scrapped?
Didn't actually mention that. It just said, well, yeah, it's I think it refers to growing global competition in this space. So China has targeted its own crew moon landing by 2030. NASA are saying that this approach would help accelerate progress and lay foundational groundwork.
Why does it have to be a race? Like, why can't they both go to the moon when they're ready?
I think NASA are thinking beyond the moon. I think they're preparing for the next giant leap and sending astronauts to Mars. So this is almost like part of the stepping stone approach that would build on the research that's conducted, help NASA identify ways to keep astronauts safe and healthy and productive and all that stuff during flight missions. But to me, it seems to be looking at accelerating that progress, looking at Mars more so.
Right. Okay. I think it was a heat shield was the problem with the Artemis launch.
Radiation. Yeah.
So, Isaac Mann has talked about this China race. I just don't understand like why everything has to be what they're doing and what we're doing. Like that's not, to me, certainly for the last 50 years, that has not been the spirit of space exploration. It has not been about a race. But anyway, the world's a different place. Our third story, Fergus, has to do with birds.
Yes, so this is all about blue tits. So blue tits, they build their nests typically in hollows or often in nest boxes. And when you're a bird and you're building a nest, you're going to be very selective about what you put in your home. And what these birds are often known to do is they will pick aromatic plants, so the likes of lavender, which give off a scent, but often the chemicals that are coming off as part of that scent can actually give a degree of protection. Mm. So they're essentially a repellent.
Like to repel insects or other birds or what?
Yeah, exactly. So like as an insecticide.
Right, okay.
Essentially. Now, where this particular study in Poland was looking at is that these birds had been observed to be putting cigarette butts into their nests.
Huh.
So the question is, why? Are they just picking up random things or are they specifically targeting the cigarette butts? And they did a really, really lovely study on this. So they looked at 100 different birds and they hatched them in three different types of nest boxes. The first type is the control, that's just a regular nest box. The second type was a nest box, the interior of which had sterilized artificial moss and cotton wool. And then the third type was a regular nest box, but with two used cigarette butts in it.
Right.
And the researcher, to be fair to him, he said that he used a mechanical bellows to smoke the cigarettes mechanically because he didn't want to smoke them and he didn't want anyone else.
It's unethical, as you expect. I mean, why you couldn't beat them up off the ground, but whatever.
Exactly. So anyway, after 2 weeks, the chicks in the nests were given a health check. So things like the length of their wings, and they also took some blood samples. Now, the key findings are the chicks in the nests that had the cigarette butts and the chicks in the nests that were in the artificial sterile nests, they had the same good blood scores, indicating quite a good physiological condition. On top of that, after the chicks had actually left the nest, they looked at the parasite populations of the nest materials.
Okay.
And what they found is that there were more parasites in the natural control nests, hardly any in the artificial nests, but in the nest with the cigarette butts, that was in between.
Okay.
So not as bad as the natural one, but not as good as the artificial one, but some sort of...
So there was a protection there.
There was a protection there, exactly. So essentially there appears to be some form of insecticide effect happening as a result of the presence of these cigarette butts. Now, in a strange way, this isn't necessarily new, because there was a paper a number of years ago that looked at house finches in Mexico, which found that they were putting up to, from 8 to 10 cigarette butts into their nest. Huh. Then, to be fair to the researchers, they then tested that. They added more live ticks into the nests. And what did the birds do? They responded by putting more cigarette butts.
No way. Into their own nest. Okay, so they knew something was going on.
Yeah. So they know that there appears to be a benefit to their chicks in the short term.
Yeah.
But is there a long-term downside to this?
Yeah, you imagine there might be, but really interesting. Our final story, Shelley, has to do with spinal muscular atrophy. Remind me what that is.
Yeah, so it's spinal muscular atrophy, or SMA. It's a rare genetic condition, and it causes progressive muscle wastage. It affects about 1 in 14,000 births, and what it does really is it impacts movement, breathing and swallowing, and it can be quite devastating in that life expectancy can be about 2 years without treatment. But the good news is, in Scotland, they've become the first part of the UK to introduce routine screening for this. In Scotland, about 3 or 4 babies are born every year with SMA. In Ireland, there's about 6 babies born every year. So the introduction of this early screening is so important, because what often happens is babies don't get diagnosed until after they display symptoms. And at that stage, they have a much more limited options of treatment, because there's been damage done to nerve cells and that cannot be reversed. Right. So with SMA, clock is always ticking and time is everything. So now that there's early identification possible in Scotland, and this is actually through funding from the government in Scotland as well as the pharma company Novartis, this SMA screening is offered for newborns through the existing heel prick test, which you're probably familiar with. It's been available in Ireland since the 1960s. We don't have SMA testing as part of our screening yet, but it's done about 4 days after birth. And what happens is it's a routine screening for babies. A healthcare professional takes a few drops of blood from the baby's heel. This blood is then placed on a card, sent to a lab for testing. So the fact that SMA is being added to this screening in Scotland now allows doctors to identify the condition before symptoms appear. And being able to treat this pre-symptomatically means the difference between somebody or a child being able to walk, use a wheelchair, or someone being able to breathe independently or require lifelong ventilation support. And actually, the outcomes can be quite phenomenal when they're treated early. There can be evidence of little to no muscular weakness as a realistic outcome measure, which is phenomenal. Yeah.
Because I was wondering there, when you were going through those numbers, I was thinking 3 a year, 6 a year to have every single baby in a country go through this test. Are there not candidates that might be more, have more impact when you're going to add something to a national a screening program? That's a really big deal. I was thinking, God, it's not that those cases, of course, aren't really important, but the key to this story, it sounds like, is that the heel prick test allows you to intervene and actually make a big impact in those small number of cases. And I guess that's why it made it onto this heel prick test.
Yeah, it's life-changing for these families. Children are being given the life they deserve. Hmm. It is being run as a 2-year pilot only, but I'm sure it will be extended in Scotland. So it's now part of the newborn screening. And in Ireland, it was actually, I did a little bit of reading around it because I was thinking, why on earth aren't we doing that in Ireland? But it is, it has actually been announced back in 2023 by the Minister for Health that it will be added to the National Newborn Screening Programme here. And Dr. Declan O'Rourke, he's a consultant paediatric neurologist in Temple Street, and he has said it's very close to being rolled out here. But for now, it's a brilliant step forward for Scotland, and hopefully it'll put pressure on other countries to follow suit.
Shelley and Fergus, thank you so much. Now, high above us, there are white streaks that trail behind planes very often, and they might look harmless, but they're quietly shaping our climate in quite a big way. What if tackling aviation's impact could be affected by flying just a little higher or just a little lower? Contrails could hold the key. Joining me now is Dr. Jesse Smith, Research Associate in Sustainable Aviation at the Department of Engineering at the University of Cambridge. Welcome to the programme, Jesse.
Thanks for having me, Jonathan.
We have to say this because there is a lot of stuff out there, right? We have to say from the very beginning, the stuff that comes out of planes is not chemtrails.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, contrails, not chemtrails. That's, a message I have to keep repeating.
Yeah. So what exactly is a contrail and what's in it?
Well, as you said, you can see them behind the aircraft, but what's mainly in them is water vapour. They're formed from the soot that comes out of the back of aircraft. And what it does is it grabs onto this water vapour in the air and it forms ice crystals on this soot. And that's what forms the clouds that we can see in the sky today.
It's essentially like a floating cloud of ice.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
How does it stay in the sky then?
Well, clouds stay in the sky, I guess is maybe the best way to think about it. The crystals are not that large. They are falling towards the earth quite slowly. And that's how a contrail sometimes eventually terminates. So it, you know, the crystals are spread out, they fall towards the earth, and then they sublimate back into the atmosphere. However, in that time, they have an incredibly strong warming impact, which is what our research is about.
Yeah. So when they're first formed, they can be almost razor sharp lines in the sky, certainly from the ground,
yes.
Right? Because the exhaust is, you know, relatively narrow compared to the size of the sky. But over time, due to what? Entropy, I guess. These really sharp pipes of water vapor start to diffuse into the air above us. And that's a problem.
Yeah, exactly. It's to do with diffusion. So, and also convection. So there's lots of different air currents in the air that sort of spread these clouds out. And as you say, they're a problem because the spreading of them traps more of the heat into the atmosphere that leaves the earth, a little bit like what CO2 does, but in a slightly different way. It warms the atmosphere.
But I mean, when we look at a plane in the sky and the temporary nature of this, are they having a negligible effect, or is this quite significant? Because, you know, you only see them every once in a while, and they disappear pretty quickly.
Yeah, they do relative to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and their effect is variable. But on average, they have a strong warming impact. The reason why they have a strong warming impact on average is because there's so many flights, annually. So the second that one sort of dissipates away, another one replaces it. And just the accumulation of all of these contrails dissipating, reforming has an annual impact that is about the same as what all CO2 is from aviation annually.
What?
Yeah.
That can't be right. You're saying the warming of the planet from CO2 emissions is equivalent to the warming
from aviation.
From aviation.
That's key. So I'm not saying that the global annual impact of CO2 is the same as contrails. I'm saying all of the CO2 from aviation, that impact is about the same as the impact from contrails in terms of temperature annually.
Oh my God. Wow. I know. Were you surprised to find out that? That's incredible.
I mean, I knew that the size was, it was going to be big, but I guess I was surprised that it was going to be that big. I was also surprised that there was quite an easy solution to get rid of this impact relative to CO2.
Right, we'll get to that in a second, but I'm just wondering how you did this modelling, because I suppose there was a moment in time where there were no flights, right? During COVID, there was a period in the data set that where there was no flights at all. Is that useful in terms of creating a baseline?
It was useful for observing the reduction in contrails. So there wasn't completely no flights over COVID. There were some flights over COVID. But the reduction in the number of flights was, it's quite useful for comparison when, so this is sort of beyond my research, but there's a lot of other very good research out there about the reduction in observed contrails during COVID.
Yeah. So let's talk about what you did model then. How did you do this experiment and how did you come to these figures?
So we used a reduced order climate model developed at MIT. So it's called the ACAE model. So it's what it does is, or what we did was we took lots of different aviation profiles into the future. So we looked at how CO2 was likely to evolve into the future, carbon dioxide. And we also looked at how contrail warming was likely to develop into the future. So the sort of kilometers of contrails formed, how that related to the sort of energy, the power locked up, and then how that related to the temperature warming impact of contrails. So that's how we did it. And then we also looked at the impact of stopping forming these contrails in one particular way.
So this is all modeling. None of this is actually from real data.
This is all modelling. I mean, it is, it's based on historical data and it's based on trends that we see into the future. It's a modelling project, yes.
Right, okay. And so I guess I was just wondering, is that something that we can't measure now with data that we have now? Is that not possible?
There are ways to sort of assess the warming impact of contrails, and we're sure that it has a warming impact. There is still work to be done to know the exact warming impact.
Okay.
But we are sure, based on observation and also based on good mechanistic models, that the warming impact is, as I say, a similar order of magnitude to CO2.
So it is possible to reduce this dramatically with just a slight change. Can you talk us through that?
Yes. So the change we looked into was navigational contrail avoidance. That's what we call it, or contrail avoidance for short. And all that involves is, you know, I said about how contrails are formed in humid patches of air in the upper atmosphere. It involves just moving slightly upwards or downwards your flight paths to avoid these humid patches of air. The humid patches of air tend to be quite flat in nature. They're like a pancake. So they tend to extend quite far laterally, but not far up and down. So what that means is you can divert your aircraft slightly lower or slightly higher and hopefully avoid these contrails.
Right.
And I say hopefully because it's still a work in progress. But even at a limited level of effectiveness, we see a big difference.
So these sort of layers of humid air, which are prone to creating contrails, are sort of hovering at a certain altitude. And I'm wondering, is it possible to know where this humid air is? Do we map that sort of information? Because it sounds like a no-brainer if we know where it is and we can avoid making contrails.
There are estimates of it at the moment, yes. So numerical weather prediction or numerical weather modelling can go a long way to knowing where these humid patches of air are. However, it's not perfect at the moment. We've got limited reliability of modelling. However, even with that limited reliability, we can make a big difference.
Have you spoken to aviation experts on what the feasibility is of adjusting flight paths to avoid humid swaths of air?
It's something that's ongoing at the moment, actually. A big part of the solution to this problem is working with operators, so air traffic controllers and pilots, to get a solution that will work for everyone. But yes, there are people within the industry who are enthusiastic about trying this.
Right. And so have you figured out what sort of an impact that would have? Because just if you're just joining us, we're speaking about contrails, these water vapor streams that come out of aircraft when they pass through humid patches of air. And they have an enormous effect, it seems, on the global warming effect. In fact, what Dr. Jesse Smith from the University of Cambridge is saying is that from their models, the climate warms the same amount from the contrails that are created from aviation as the actual use of fuel in aviation, which is just an enormous amount, as we all know. So this is pretty significant. Is this the first time someone has realized or identified a way to avoid creating contrails? Is this a new idea, Jesse, of adjusting flight height?
I wouldn't say it's a new idea. No, I think this has been practiced on a small scale for quite a long time. However, I guess I would say the world is only just waking up to, in the last 20, 30 years, is only just waking up to, well, even the issues with climate change and global warming. So this technique has been practiced in the past.
Why, out of interest, but it's not been done for this purpose.
For example, if you wanted to show where a plane was flying, if you wanted to show where a plane was flying or where a plane wasn't flying, you might want to produce a contrail or not produce a contrail.
Right.
Now, I think they would normally do it by adjusting the engine outputs, because if you're doing it for something that isn't on a large scale, it maybe is more reliable just to affect the power of the engine.
Right.
But of course, that would increase the fuel consumption associated with creating or not creating a contrail. So it's a slightly different method of doing a similar thing. But I guess what hasn't been done on a very, very large scale yet, on a fleet-wide scale, is trying to get rid of these contrails to reduce aviation's climate impact.
Wow. I'm absolutely blown away. So presumably a lot of people are interested in this.
Well, I am.
But I mean, this sort of research, having the data to suggest what an impact it could have. I mean, presumably, if you adjust your flight path, we're talking about very significant, if the numbers are so big, very significant savings in global warming as a result of contrails, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's normally doom and gloom when we talk about aviation and sustainability. There's lots of things you can do, but a lot of them cost quite a lot of money or require quite massive changes to the system. This is something that does not require such massive changes, and it's arguably a lot less expensive than some of the other changes that you can implement.
I mean, on one hand, right, it's very exciting because, you know, it's tackling a massive problem. On the other hand, I didn't even know this is a problem.
So in my mind, it sort of just
cancels itself out. And it's neither a good thing nor a bad thing. But obviously it is a good thing. But I didn't realize we had a bad thing in the first place. I mean, I knew obviously CO2 emissions was a massive problem with aviation, but I didn't realize we also had the double whammy of contrails. Anyway, really interesting speaking with you, Jesse. The best of luck with your research. And I hope you get to affect aviation behavior. That'd be amazing.
Yeah, I'd really hope so too. Thanks so much for talking to me, Jonathan, and for such an interesting conversation.
All right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we had Dr. Anna Georgiades talking about hallucinations last week. Lots of really interesting comments coming in. We were talking about dreams. Damien said, I have one tattoo on my forearm. My recurring dream is getting more tattoos and not being happy with them. I go around seeing if they can get fixed, but they can't be fixed. Does this mean that I shouldn't get any more tattoos or that I'm not happy with life as it is? That is a really good question, Damien. I don't know. Are you happy with life as it is? I mentioned last week that the people love talking about their dreams and always want to know what the meaning is. We have no answers. Science has no answers for what these dreams mean. But they're very interesting to hear nonetheless. Lisa says, I often dream I'm wandering my secondary school's corridors and going into the empty classrooms. No idea why. Yeah, the being nude at school or being, you know, having no trousers on and realizing you're at the front of the class dream is weirdly, like, it's weirdly popular. I always dream that I'm doing something normal and then I have to suddenly leave my family and go on the run, and I'm totally fine about it. Every time. Doesn't matter what I'm doing. I turn into Jason Bourne and I'm like, oh, this is quite exciting. Oh, I could start a new life here. And I don't know why. And we had another dream from Janet who says her strangest dream is disembarking off some kind of boat onto a jetty and dancing with a huge green dragon. These are the only things I remember vividly, but even after many decades, I can remember the exact colour of the dragon and wondering if I should have asked the man if I could dance with his dragon. I think there's more to that story that I don't think we'll go in. That's it from this episode. Thanks to Marisa O'Sullivan producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, Hugo de Silva sound, and thank you for listening. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.